What's up, y'all? This is Tony Powell, and you're listening to Powell to the People podcast, episode 22. You know, this past week, I've spent a lot of time, I guess, holiday season. I don't know what it is, but I've been doing a lot of Netflix and chilling. And I've been watching a lot of these goofy shows. I saw one, I'm watching one called Nightfall, and it's about the Templar Knights, you know. And I noticed something, and I watched another show about Marco Polo. I've been streaming that and watching this thing, Marco Polo, and it's about the time that Marco Polo spent with Kublai Khan, you know, and the Mongols. And what I found interesting is that there's always, I guess in all of these things, there's always some sort of mission these guys have to go on, some sort of stealth mission where they, you know, have to sneak up on the enemy, or the enemy sneaking up on them. And usually, you know, especially in these period pieces, there's some sort of warning signal. You know, in the Mongol movie, what happened was they were sneaking up at night, and you know, as they saw the approach of the enemy, somebody launched a flaming arrow into the sky to alert all of the defenders to, you know, that we're under attack. And in the Nightfall movie, the same thing. You know, somebody sees somebody approaching, and they start, you know, screaming and yelling and blowing a horn, you know, hoot, and everybody gets up and they start running, and you see a whole lot of motion. And I said, wow, you know, that's kind of funky, because all of our lives we're constantly being, you know, warned about something. You know, so many different warnings. You know, as you come to a railroad crossing, you know, the two gates drop down and there's this loud clanging and the flashing red lights telling you not to cross the track. You know, as you approach a snake, you're walking out in the wilderness and you hear the distinct rattle of an eastern or western diamondback, and that's a warning not to approach it. But you'd be amazed at how many people, especially out here in New York, you know, Long Island Railroad, how many people, and I've ridden the Long Island Railroad a lot of times, how many people will see the gates down, see the clanging, you know, horn, the clanging bell, the flashing, alternating flashing red lights, and will still try to drive around those gates to get to the other side because they're late, and get smashed. You'd be surprised at how many people get bit playing with that snake after they already heard the rattle. So my point is, I'm not really sure if we're really hardwired, you know, as a people, as a society, to pay attention to warnings. You know, I mean, we have them all over the place. I mean, how many people drive all day long with the check engine light on and never stop to pull over to find out what's going on with the car? They just say, well, it's all right, the car's running, I'm getting in the car, I'm driving with the check engine light. So I bring all that up to say that sometimes, you know, you have to pay attention to the canary in the coal mine. You have to pay attention. If you go down a coal mine and you look in your cage and you see a little canary on his back with his feet pointing towards the sky, that's a sign you need to pay attention to. So I decided this week for Powell to the People, episode 22, that I was going to pay attention to some of the canaries in the coal mine. And some of the canaries in the coal mine I'm talking about, I mean, you guys know, if you listen to the show, if you've been subscribing, you know that I'm really, really, you know, I love my politics. And I found this woman on Twitter. You know, I just, you know, people kept tweeting her, and I kept reading the tweets. I kept looking around. I kept seeing the tweets. And I said, wow, this is really fascinating. Because I think in our democracy right now, there are two people who are truly the canaries in the coal mine. They are the flashing gate at the railroad crossing. They are the rattle of the snake. They are paying attention. They are trying to let us know what's going on. One of them is Greg Palast, who I could not get today. But the other one I could. This young lady, this woman, Jennifer Cohn, is an election integrity advocate, writer, and journalist. She graduated from the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA, in 1989, and is a Hastings College of Law graduate in 1993. Since the 2016 election, she's focused her professional efforts exclusively on investigating and exposing our country's insecure computerized elections. She was a law partner at Nielsen and Haley and Abbott in Marin County for many years, where she specialized in insurance coverage and civil appeals. Before that, she specialized in criminal appellate law. I want to introduce you to my guest for this podcast, Ms. Jennifer Cohn. Jennifer, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you doing? Thank you for having me on.
Oh, no pressure, no problem.
And tweet. I guess I'm a canary.
You are one of the canaries in the coal mine. I mean, yes. You know, our democracy has been under assault since, well, actually, I think it's been under assault since 2000. I think in 2000, with the Bush v. Gore decision, when the Supreme Court appointed Bush, and there were some shenanigans with the, with our elections even then. You know, I think that was a, that was a dry run. That was a test. That was a test to see whether or not, as I said, people would respond to the flaming arrow in the sky, and they didn't. And then in 2004, you know, Ohio, again, the Secretary of State, Ken Blackwell, said, I guarantee that Bush will win Ohio. And then there was all kinds of shenanigans with, I believe it was the Diebold machines.
Well, it was either Diebold or ESNS, but there were a lot of shenanigans with a backup server routing Ohio's election night results through a hosting company owned by a company called SmartTech, which had a sort of very partisan guy in charge of the company, and they ran a lot of the RNC IT and the Bush White House. They did IT for the Bush White House and that sort of thing, and before it was routed through that hosting company, before the results were routed through there,
right.
It was 11:15 at night, and Kerry was ahead. And then after the servers went down for a little bit, and then after the servers went back up, Bush was ahead where he remained.
Right, and Kerry never really, really challenged it. And I think that's part of the problem, is that people don't really know to challenge it. And so I say all that to bring us to now, because, you know, you would have thought that in the intervening years that someone would have said, hey, what's going on here? And as I said, you know, there are some people of election, you know, integrity advocates such as yourself who are watching these things. But I think to the general public, it's something that they don't really pay attention to. As I said, it's you know,
I think that's right. I mean, so John Kerry, he had, I'm sure it seemed like a good idea at the time to not say anything, but it turns out, you know, so that was 2004. So 14 years later, about a month ago, he was on the Brian Lehrer show.
Right.
And he said that his campaign actually did suspect electronic vote tampering during that election in 2004. And they didn't file an election challenge. But I guess even before the election, they were concerned that there might be some tampering. And they tried to get a court order that would have let them look at, he called them the voting machine algorithms.
Right.
And the court denied his campaign that relief on the basis that all voting machine vendors consider, well, all private vendors consider their code to be proprietary. So you really can't get forensic analysis through the courts, at least thus far. But unfortunately, by remaining silent, I think it really allowed this problem to fester and without most of the public being aware of it. And certainly I wasn't aware of it. I didn't wake up to any of these concerns until the 2016 election. But there are quite a few advocates who have been concerned since then, and I think you may even be one of them. And he really, frankly, Kerry did a bit of a disservice to them, because many of them have been labeled conspiracy theorists such over the years, and yet it turns out his own campaign suspected the very same thing.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, voter suppression is an obvious tactic. You know,
right.
you can see that
in the sunlight.
Right. You can see it. I mean, you know, when you know that there's lines around the block because there's one voting machine in a neighborhood that might vote Democratic, and there's 10,000 voting machines at the country club, that's kind of obvious. Or when people are just purged because their names suggest that they might be Democratic voters. Again, because it's in broad daylight, you can see it. I'm always concerned about, you know, people will say, well, you know, does my vote really count? I think that's really the issue. You know, if I'm punching a paper ballot, you know, and I physically, mechanically punch that paper ballot, and, you know, you can see a hole through where I punched it, maybe that's not a bad way to go. But when I cast a vote in a machine and there's no recourse, there's no way to know that my vote was counted. I mean, when I go to the ATM and I take out $10, there's a receipt, there's an accounting of what I took out, of what I did, when I did it, how much I took out, and how much is left. And I can't understand.
Yeah, there are a lot of complicating factors when it comes to receipts for voting.
Talk about it.
So, well, I mean, first of all, you talked about the punching the hole. Actually, those can be rigged as well. So those were the punch cards that played a large part in bringing us voting machines in the first place. And it, subsequent to that 2000 election, where there was sort of the big debacle with both punch card ballots and butterfly ballots.
Right.
That's how we got the voting machines. But it also turned out, I believe it was employees of Sequoia voting systems, which was about 20%, I think, of election equipment, at least until recently. It is did some of the punch cards in Florida during that election, and some of its employees came out and said that it was deliberately rigged. The holes were either the paper stuck or the lining up of the holes or something. Because you can rig punch cards by making the polls too big or too small, by altering the weight of the paper apparently can affect it as well. And the other company,
is that something that's consciously done, or is it a fluke
That's the thing, is it's always people always have the excuse that oops, well I just turned the dial a fraction and it changed the size of the holes and I didn't mean to do it. It's very hard to prove intent. And ES&S is the other vendor that provided the punch cards. And ES&S is currently 44% of U.S. election equipment. So, I mean, I think that the gold standard
Let me ask this question before you go into it.
Marked with a pen. So paper ballots marked with a pen is the gold standard. Certainly above and beyond touchscreen voting machines where you're punching your selections into a machine and then either nothing printed out or something is printed out. Sorry, that's my other line. Well, it'll stop in a second, I hope.
Okay. This is how we do it, folks. It's live podcast, and we're using
that.
The technology. That's all right. Carry on.
In any event, pen and paper is the gold standard. Unfortunately, even with that gold standard right now, really the only two options that are on the table as far as national security groups are concerned are either, on the one hand, hand-marked paper ballots counted on scanners. That's one option. And then the other option is computer-marked, barcoded, they call them paper ballots, from touchscreen ballot markers and scanners. So scanners either way is sort of the default at the moment. And then the question is, do you add on yet another layer of opaque election equipment with these touchscreen ballot markers, or at least let voters have a truly software independent record of voter intent by having them mark their ballots by hand. And
as an election integrity advocate, what seems to you're saying that's the gold standard right now. What are the other recommendations that people who are watching that think they should we should enact?
Well, what I would like to see is hand marked paper ballots hand counted on election night.
Physically counted, hand counted. Okay.
I think that's what is done in much of Europe. And unfortunately, in the United States, most people have been really not paying much attention to this issue, so there aren't a lot of sort of nationally recognized, reputable election integrity groups. And the few that are out there are not talking about hand-counted elections. And I think that there are reasons for that. I mean, at sort of the most basic level, I think they tend to have people in there who used to work at IBM, and so they have sort of a and tech people. So they have a technology bias, and they just can't grasp the concept that we would not use any technology at all in our elections, even though they, they're supposed to be advocating for election integrity.
Right.
And the concern is that whereas Europe, yes, they do these publicly hand-counted elections. That's great for Europe, but they say that our ballots are too complicated. It's really not true, because there are some counties in the United States that do hand-counted elections, and the one that really stands out is New Hampshire. And they have done it. I mean, granted, New Hampshire is not a large state, but it really doesn't matter, because the way that they do it is they limit the number of voters per precinct to either 500 or 1,000, and certainly could do that in any large state as well. It's really the largeness is really decided on the precinct size, not the state size.
Okay.
And so then they hand count publicly at the precinct. And If you're thinking in terms of how to prevent fraud with your elections, anything that transparency is really what you aim for. So election equipment of any sort is not transparent. And any time you have something that's not transparent, it's an invitation for fraud, because people can't see it, like you pointed out. So publicly hand counting on election night, paper ballots marked by hand, is the most transparent and therefore the least prone fraud, if it were viable. If it's not, then you just use the least amount of equipment as possible. So that would be hand-marked ballots with scanners, and then post-election manual audits done publicly.
Okay, so again, you said that that's the way they do it in Europe, and I think you started to address the numerical situations in states like you know, California, New York, Texas, where you have...
Exactly. California is always the one that's brought up by these groups to say that we couldn't do hand-counted elections in the United States. In California, it would be probably difficult. I think we have the most complicated ballot of the entire country, upwards of 50 items maybe on the ballot.
Okay.
And many, many... you know, different languages and such, making it complicated. I don't know that just because, I'm not sure that California can't do it. I think you'd have to try it out. Different, you know, you certainly could make it impossible with a really disorganized approach to it. I don't think there's been an attempt to try it.
If
California can't do it, that's not a reason for the rest of the country
to not do it.
To not do it.
With a hand-counted ballot, then, and you're saying that you would, that the goal would be to limit the precincts to 500 people per precinct, 500.
I think that's right.
500 voters per precinct. So, in terms of cost, how does that affect cost? Or are we still talking about, you know, mostly volunteers? Or are we talking about funds
so
allocated?
In New Hampshire,
for
they do it with volunteers, and the cost is infinitely less than using obviously election equipment.
Really?
So if you're talking about I have it. So, as you know, I've got a Twitter account. It's at Jenny Cohn 1, JennyCohn1. But I can put to the top of my Twitter feed if you want today.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
New Hampshire, because it included some cost breakdowns. And it was from 2007, but they did cost breakdowns comparing the hand-marked, hand-counted elections to a touch screen.
And in terms of accuracy, I mean, could you put a percentage on the accuracy?
So there's two things. There is a possibility of mistakes, frankly, either way.
Okay.
And so, yes, there are errors that I think with hand counting, you try to do it double. So you organize people into think and you have everybody double checking each other's work. I read through it at one time, but it isn't really fresh in my mind. But yes, there are going to be a possibility of errors, but there also is a very large possibility of human error in many different respects when it comes to, at the moment we're just talking about hand-counted versus hand-marked and scanners, I guess.
Right.
Scanners have calibration issues, as you've heard about. There are many different, they can be programmed even or mistakenly calibrated so that they're either more or less receptive to the marks on the ballot. They certainly can be programmed intentionally to flip votes. But at least with errors, it goes both ways. I tend to focus on, so it sort of washes out,
okay.
I think. It should, more or less. I'm not going to say that it's impossible that it could ever affect an election outcome, but errors shouldn't typically favor one candidate over the other, whereas fraud, the opportunity and possibility of fraud is so much greater with the electronic equipment. And that would be, you know, fraud by its nature is to favor one side versus the other.
Exactly. So in your experience and in your research, we're talking about, the right, you know, Trump and the right have constantly screamed, you know, especially this was just, insane during the Obama years, talking about voter fraud. You know, in-person
right.
voter fraud, which is a felony. And I don't know anybody in their right mind who would decide they want to go to jail so they can cast a vote for anybody
else. For their one extra vote, yeah.
Right. But I think the bigger fear should be, and this is why we're talking about it, this is why I wanted to have this conversation, is election fraud. And election
right.
fraud, I think, is probably not only more likely, but it's been happening over years. And I think you had mentioned earlier something going on now in Pennsylvania that someone brought to your attention. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I just want to say briefly on the whole election fraud, voter fraud, people do get very confused as to the distinction.
Right.
And election fraud has more process at the election, whereas voter fraud is really in-person voter impersonation. So
right.
Or trying to vote twice or whatever, but the easiest way to distinguish it is with election fraud, you're not saying the voters themselves did anything wrong, whereas with voter fraud, it is the voters themselves. It is an individual voter trying to vote twice or trying to vote illegally or impersonating someone else. That's voter fraud. And that's sort of been it's not that it never happens, but the notion that it happens on any sort of mass scale is
ludicrous based on the numbers I've seen.
It's ludicrous, but you're right, based on human nature, why would anybody risk deportation or prison time to give one extra vote?
Right.
And so it becomes, it's very unlikely, and it's certainly never been proven on any type of mass scale. And I actually think that unlike election fraud, it's relatively provable, I think.
Well,
want to explore, but in any event, it's a myth that was propagated by the Bush administration, and
right.
They spent 5 years trying to find mass voter fraud and failed. So I think it's maybe intended as a deflection
from the actual crime
of election fraud, which has not actually been proven either, but it's much more difficult because it really would only take one person to commit election fraud. I tend to focus on the voting machines, but there are issues with obviously absentee ballot fraud can be a type of election fraud. With the voting machines, it really just takes one person to rig an entire election. With voter fraud, you'd have to have many, 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 many people impersonating non-voters and illegal aliens. That's why election fraud. So in Pennsylvania, I never claim to know for sure that election fraud has occurred. I mean, unless it is ever actually proven in a court of law or someone, you know, frankly, even when people admit it, even when people have come forward as sort of whistleblowers, there's always a he said, she said. So I just like to put out the red flags that
are
there.
Yes, a question before you go on. Is that a function of the fact that these things happen in a black box because they're happening electronically and most of us are not capable of grasping, you know, the science and the mathematics behind it?
So that's exactly why voting machines are so dangerous. And so Germany, for example, in 2009, you had election officials, much like in the U.S., that were clinging with white knuckles to their voting machines. And by voting machine, as opposed to scanner, I mean the black. They're actually both opaque. They both are. They're both black boxes. But voting machines are worse because they don't use paper ballots,
right?
At all. And so in Germany, the election officials were clinging to them, and it took a court action to get them ruled unconstitutional by the German Constitutional Court. And the reasoning of the court was. They didn't say voting machines are unconstitutional. What they said is that the average citizen has to be able to observe and understand the process used to count the votes, or otherwise it's ripe for fraud, and it violates the right to a free and fair election. And so by definition, even though they didn't have to say all voting machines are unconstitutional, that has been sort of the practical effect of it.
I'm struck by that.
We would desperately need a similar ruling in the United States, and there are some... There's a few lawsuits that are sort of being teed up that I hope will head that way. But, yeah, in Pennsylvania, you asked about Pennsylvania. So,
right.
Actually, going back to why we don't know about it, it does kind of require a whistleblower, and even then it tends to be a he said, she said, because the forensic evidence of election rigging can be erased. And maybe one place where some people think that there was about to be a whistleblower is the 2004 election. So remember I mentioned that backup server that routed Ohio's election results through a Republican hosting site in Chattanooga, Tennessee. So the guy that designed it was known as the Republican IT guru. His name was Mike Connell. And he's the one who designed it. And there was actually a lawsuit over that 2004 election. So there's an election and a couple of election integrity advocates and were attorneys and they in Ohio and they filed a lawsuit and they subpoenaed him for trial. And soon after he was subpoenaed for trial, he died in a plane crash. So, you know,
it's ripe for conspiracy theory.
Yeah. An unfortunate coincidence, but, in any event, and there are also the vendors tend to sue people who anyone who publishes anything negative
about
them. So, for example, when independent IT experts have done analysis of the machines, they have been sued for publishing results that tend to show that election equipment. I think ES&S and Diebold were notorious or have been notorious for filing lawsuits to prevent people from exposing the vulnerabilities in their election equipment. So that tends to silence people.
So what could be done, legislatively to further to gain more integrity in our elections?
There's sort of a myth that the states did everything when it comes to elections. And under the Constitution, that's not true. They get to do it, but Congress gets to overrule them with regulations. And I can't remember, it's article something, section something, but there is something specific which says that it basically says, you know, except Congress may enact such regulations to overrule it, except as to the time and place of electing senators, something like that.
Okay.
So Congress absolutely can override the states in this area, but there is a long tradition of states' rights in the United States, which you may have known this. I didn't know this until recently, that states' rights, really, that phrase.
Oh, no, the hair on the back of my neck just stood up. Yeah.
It basically meant we want to have the right to.
Right.
I don't know if it was the right to have slaves so much as the right to discriminate, but.
Oh, that's pretty much what it is. I mean, anytime you say states' rights to a black person, they would kind of lose their minds.
So. Right. And the South would say, get off our back. Right. We have the right to do what we want, to treat other races unfairly. And so it's unfortunately, people don't think of it when, at least I didn't, when the southern states would say, well, we have states' rights to conduct our elections. I didn't really realize the origin of that phrase, and it's sort of chilling when you realize that we're still talking about they want to be able to do what they want with their elections, and their justification has to do, is a phrase that went back to discriminating against African Americans.
So, the irony is that was one of the things that the states' writers were constantly advocating for, and that was to deny the right to vote. I mean,
exactly.
The poll taxes and all of these things.
Probably part and parcel of the same thing. And so you asked about Pennsylvania. I'm sorry, I took a long turnaround.
No, listen, I want to take the whole trip. Actually, my producer just handed me the election laws. It says the Constitution simply states that the times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislator thereof. But the Congress may at any time, by law, make or alter such regulations. Article 1, Section 4.
You guys are good. All right, Article 1, Section 4. I've really got to remember that. I've got to memorize that because, saying Article something, Section something isn't very impressive. But, yes, that is it. So yes, Congress absolutely could do it. It also could be done at the state level, by the way. So your state legislatures.
But it generally tends to follow that the states that would be those that would want to kind of, live in the shadows in terms of election integrity are those states that have historically suppressed the vote.
So it would be better done at the congressional level. And unfortunately, without having control of the Senate, we're not going to get a good election security bill. But what really drives me crazy, and this is maybe not having actually negotiated bills in Congress myself, maybe I'm just naive, but I feel like the bills that come out, so for example, Amy Klobuchar's Secure Elections Act,
right?
By the time it came out, it was so watered. I feel like there's too much negotiating with yourself that goes on before these bills are presented, and you should present
what you believe.
Maybe not just go full hand marked, hand counted. Maybe that's unrealistic at the moment. It shouldn't be, but without any nationally recognized group calling for it, maybe that is. But the hand marked paper ballots really is not a compromise we should be making, and yet her bill does, and it would allow states to force voters to use these touchscreen voting machines or not touchscreen voting machines. Well, actually, I think it allows that, too. I don't think it requires anything. But if you're going to get federal funding, I think it would require that you use either hand-marked paper ballots or these touchscreen barcode balloting systems. And that I have a real problem with. And so some would say, well, if we're not going to get it, we shouldn't even put it in. But the problem with not even putting it in is the public is in the dark that there's a thing, that there's a difference between hand-marked paper ballots and computer-marked paper ballots.
In the process of listening to you, I'm sitting here and my producer's sitting here nodding his head, and we're both sitting here going, yeah, okay, there is an issue. And to me,
it's largely issue spotting, and we need our leaders to tell people there's an issue there, whether they can get it through Congress or not. But I think they should try, because especially if they do it publicly, Republican voters care about this every bit as much as Democratic voters.
Right.
And it's the leaders that don't seem to care about it. And so I think if it's publicly vetted, there is no defense for using these touchscreens. There's nothing, there's no benefit to them. It's actually, I think, a breach of, I'm interested in looking into this, whether you can sue your members of Congress for breach of fiduciary duty. I know that there are, maybe you can't, maybe it's obvious you can't. There's a lot of
Well, you're the lawyer, but I would think that,
well,
if you're talking
taxpayer money, they cost twice as much, and right. they're much less secure. And it was obvious all along that they would be much less. The problem is, the big lie that's told is that these things are voter verifiable. And frankly, that came from this national election integrity group called Verified Voting.
Right.
And they should have known better because they made the same claims about voter verifiable paper audit trails from touchscreen voting machines, which are these like things attached to the machine that summarize your vote totals. People don't look at them, and studies have shown that people don't look at them, which means the paper trail itself can be corrupted, which means that any manual audit based on that is corrupted.
So that seems to be the case that happened in Florida, where they did this kabuki dance of auditing the vote and counting so-called counting the paper. But apparently, if you're based on what you're saying, is that that was just a fool's errand.
Well, Florida is a little different because some of Florida actually uses hand-marked paper ballots, and some of it does use these VVPATs, which are effectively useless, I'd say in particular for the down-ballot races, by which I mean anything really other than president.
Right.
Because the studies have shown that, in particular, if you can omit races entirely from the paper trail and voters won't notice, or you can substitute. So if it was supposed to be like you were voting for the District 12, it can change it to a District 14, which really isn't in contention, and voters don't notice. So studies have long shown that. And the new hot thing, I'll get to Florida in a second, but the new hot thing, which is actually, it's unfortunately not fascinating to most people, but it needs to become fascinating, and I have to find a way that I haven't found yet to make it fascinating. But the new piece of equipment that is taking over the country, at least in sort of the most problematic swing states and there always are sort of notorious counties where things just seem to always go wrong. Those are the ones that are flocking to this new breed of touchscreen, which is these touchscreen barcode ballot markers. And here's where the language gets tricky, is the vendors say that what they generate is, they don't call it a VVPAT now, they call it a paper ballot. And the problem is paper ballot isn't actually like a legally defined term typically. So they're able to do that, and so people don't know the difference. So that then these same national election integrity groups like Verified Voting have treated them as they've just called them paper ballot systems, and that's a problem because people don't realize there's a difference between that and hand-marked ballots on scanners.
What are they?
And the difference
what are they
again has to do with whether voters will actually verify. You don't need to verify a hand-marked paper ballot to make sure that a machine hasn't flipped your votes as reflected on the hand-marked paper ballot. You only need to do that if the computer is marking it for you. And a recent study just came out like a month ago shows predictably that, again, voters don't actually do that, and they certainly don't notice if tend to notice if votes are deleted or flipped as reflected. Again, this is on the paper ballot now, the computer marked one. So if you do a manual audit based on that, the manual audit will be corrupted because the paper was corrupted.
Garbage in, garbage out.
Florida is a bit different, though. Even before we get to the problem with the paper trail there, even if they had all hand-marked paper ballots, the problem is in the law in Florida, they called them manual audits, but they really weren't. And this is happens so often in the election field that there's misleading language. So for them, in Florida, manual audit means a rescan. So you just run, you don't count them by hand manually. You rescan them through the scanners, and then the ones that are either under or over, that are rejected basically by the scanner, spit out as either having an overvote, which would mean more than one selection for a candidate, or an undervote, which would mean a race left blank.
Okay.
Those are the only ones then that are manually counted, which is a small fraction. So it doesn't. If there was vote flipping, you don't get a manual.
Explain. Yeah, I mean, because what I'm getting from you is what I just said. It's you know, if you're checking the results against what you already have, it's if there was garbage going into the system, then you're going to get garbage coming out of the system. When you say flipping a vote for my audience, what are you saying?
I mean, changing it from one candidate to another. But there's sort of two elements of that. So there's there's inside the machine where your vote or where your vote is counted, right?
Uh-huh.
And then there's on this paper, the paper record, which could either be a paper ballot or a VVPAT or whatever. And so the answer that a lot of many election integrity advocates have put forward to the vote flipping that might happen inside the machine is that, well, it's not going to happen on the piece of paper, and therefore we can just do an audit based on the paper, and we can catch it no matter how bad, no matter who's in charge of our elections, even if they have criminal intent, we'll always be able to catch it because we're going to do these manual audits with the paper. And it's all kind of a farce because, number one, so they're allowing bad equipment choices to be made as we speak, on the premise that we're going to get these, they have to be good manual audits too. Let's just say we had hand-marked paper ballots. If it's just a spot check, it's not going to do anything. So they have to be what they call risk-limiting audits. And the farce is that only one state has conducted a risk-limiting audit, which is the type that these groups say it needs to be. Only one state has done it, and there's a lot of resistance to passing laws that allow them. It's gained a little traction. We're maybe up to three states now.
Which state did it, and what was the result?
So Colorado did a risk-limiting audit, and I think the election integrity movement is so desperate for victories that it was hailed as this great success. And a lot of times, if you dig deeper, it really isn't. So, for example, in Colorado, there was an element of it that made it really more of a dog and pony show because there's a random selection element to any manual audit, and there is or any meaningful manual audit. You have to randomly select the precincts or the votes or something to be counted, and they took that out of it. So the Colorado law that implemented supposedly risk-limiting audits took out the randomness element, which means it can be gamed. So I think it confirmed the result. Frankly, I don't know that Colorado is considered the most corrupt state. So there's also the fact that just because something works in a state that isn't corrupt doesn't mean it wouldn't be gamed in a state that is. The notion that we're going to get risk-limiting audits everywhere, I hope we do. I mean, that's fine. I'd be good with that. But it's speculative, and it's very irresponsible to allow bad equipment choices to make things worse on the equipment end, on the hope that someday, I mean, they're probably not going to be in effect by 2020. So Pennsylvania, for example, just reached a settlement agreement with Jill Stein where it agreed to conduct some kind of manual audit, so not even the type that these groups are calling for, by 2020. So we're going to not get them by 2022. So we're not even going to get them in 2020. And they agreed to paper ballots, but guess what? They didn't specify hand marks, so it could be those, you know, junky touchscreen barcode ballot markers that cost taxpayers twice as much money and can be gamed. So you get a gamed paper trail going into your manual audit. So there's just there is a lot of misrepresentation and confusing linguistics to lull the public into thinking that progress is being made when it really isn't. And then you don't really have one of my goals has been to educate a critical mass of people, to try to anyway, so that we can maybe get some activism going, some informed grassroots activism going, because there isn't any on this issue. No one has really sort of informed the voters.
Well,
these election integrity groups haven't done any voter outreach, so there's nobody calling their congresspeople on these issues. Unlike almost every other issue, you have people calling their legislators saying, I want this, this, and this. There's nobody knowing the difference between hand-marked and computer-marked and calling their legislators to demand it. And by the way, though, Ron Wyden has he also has an election integrity bill in Congress. He's the senator from Oregon.
Oregon, yes.
And he certainly seems to get it more than Amy Klobuchar does with her Secure Elections Act. His bill at least includes a clause that would require states to give all voters the option to mark their ballots by hand. So it's not ideal either. I would rather that these touchscreen barcode ballot markers should not actually really be allowed at all. But at least this gives us a chance where if we inform enough voters, then maybe they would do the hand marking.
Well, my question part. Is, I mean, I think the thing that stands out to me is this, and you know, we're asking the people who would most benefit from or lose as a function of really, really election integrity. You know, we're asking those people to be the ones to be, we're asking the referee
right.
to judge his own game.
You're right. And it's tricky. I mean, there are a lot of countervailing forces, but you're right. So I think we can make, well, the problem is no one's actually asking them. So okay. we are letting them come up with legislation unchecked is really what's happening. And the only input they're getting is from these national election integrity groups that seem for whatever reason to be fine with a corrupted paper trail, as long as they call it voter verifiable, and it really isn't. So you have them, and I'm speaking of verified voting in particular, because that's the one that seems to have the most national recognition. So they consult with the lawmakers, and then you have the secretaries of state, yes, some of whom, Brian Kemp comes to mind, and he loves these touchscreen barcode ballot markers, by the way.
Right.
They appear to be corrupt. And even if you put aside corruptness, well, some of them just, they develop, actually back to the corruption. ES&S is the largest voting machine vendor in the United States, and there have been more and more articles coming out about how they wine and dine their election officials. And even sort of more disturbing is they have this sort of secret, well, it is secret, it's not sort of secret. They have this secret advisory board. It's secret in the sense that they won't say who's on it. And they put state election officials on that advisory board, and then those state election officials go back and recommend, maybe not always, but it seems to be always, ES&S equipment.
Well, that's
ES&S has the number one touchscreen barcode ballot marker out there, and they make electronic poll books, which is how you check people in at the polls. You check their voter registration.
I mean, that's just straight corruption. I mean, you're paying somebody to support your machine. I mean, you know, anywhere else you get arrested for that.
The board is voluntary, but they do pay. You know, I'm not convinced they're. I don't know if there are back deals. Certainly, there is.
Listen, if these guys are getting
at these meetings, so it goes back to transparency. I don't know if you know. Cash bonuses are handed out or not.
They don't have
but
to.
They do pay for travel expenses.
I was about to say.
Yeah, they do have fancy meetings at fancy places.
Right. If ENS says, "Hey, listen, we want to have a, you know, as our volunteer, we want to bring our volunteers down to the Bahamas, you know, for a month to talk about elections." Yeah, I mean that's
they had one. I think they even. Well, I shouldn't say. There was one recently in New Orleans, I was told, and I think it involved even like a fancy boat. You know, I don't know. But they definitely had one on the Las Vegas Strip, and some people were given show tickets, and they, you know, they had dinners paid for. And at a minimum, it butters people up so that you have a very cozy relationship with these vendors. And they want to sell the most expensive equipment, which usually means more equipment, which usually means less transparent, which always means less secure. So it's a very dangerous situation, which is why we really need I can't guarantee that voter pressure would change things, but it certainly wouldn't hurt. And it actually did change things already on a very small scale, but in Georgia, which, as you know, is sort of the voter suppression central,
right?
Also, which got less attention, but in the year before, I and others had been screaming about Georgia as the epicenter of the corrupted election equipment. And there was a bill that ES&S is Georgia's current vendor, having taken over the Diebold contract when they bought out Diebold in 2009. They apparently had a lot of input into this bill. Let me back up. So Georgia has paperless touchscreen voting machines. So it doesn't even have the crappy voter verifiable paper audit trail. Has nothing. They're old, and they know from there was a paper ballot lawsuit filed by an excellent election integrity advocate named Marilyn Marks. They know from that got some publicity nationally. They know from that, and just sort of the talk nationally about how we need paper, that they've got to get rid of these machines. And so if they have to get rid of the machines, they want these touchscreen barcode ballot markers. And they got the ES&S senior VP, used to be a Georgia election official. Her name is Kathy Rogers, and she was the Georgia election official in 2002 when Georgia bought its paperless touchscreen voting
right.
machines. Now she's a big ES&S bigwig, and she apparently was working on the language in the bill to allow these barcode balloting, these touchscreen barcode balloting machines. And it almost passed because they were calling them paper ballot systems, and the media was reporting it as a paper ballot system, and the Democrats thought it was a paper ballot system, and everyone thought it was, yay, we're finally getting paper ballots, let's have a big party, until Marilyn Marks got wind of it. And she told me, and she told some election integrity activists in Georgia about it, and we just did this sort of all-out campaign to educate Georgia citizens and educate the Georgia Democrats, and it had passed 50-1 in the Senate House in one of the two houses of the state legislature, and it died at the 11th hour, just before they went into recess. The bill died. So that it did work in that small instance, but they're still back. I mean, they're about to pass. So now you have Kemp actually as the governor who wants these things, and he got his Secretary of State who wants these things. And they have a meeting coming up on Wednesday where they're about to greenlight them. I don't know what they're going to, I guess they're legislature and write the legislation to match the equipment, but they're about to give them the green light on Wednesday. And so we're trying to
stop it,
get people to go to the meeting. And of course they put the meeting like way out in the boondocks so that voters would find it difficult to get there.
It's amazing. Before we wrap this up, the two things I'm getting from you is that A, this problem is entrenched. It's not going away, but the best possible recourse we can have right now is to have hand marked ballots, and that's what we should be pushing for, because you just cleared me up in terms of paper ballots,
transparency,
right? Because I mean, you know, for the longest time I'm thinking, well, yeah, we should have paper ballots, but now you're telling me that there's these essentially junk paper ballots. They have to be hand marked in order for them to really, really be something real.
Yes, that's right. And then transparency is really the key. So that's just sort of the first step, is what's so frustrating, is if you then count those paper ballots behind closed doors, it's not going to get you anything. That you get like the absentee ballot fraud. And all, so they have to actually be, they either have to be counted in public on election night, which is my preference, or a possible fallback would be then to conduct manual audits publicly after the election. But then you also have to have like a videotaped, really, truly transparent chain of custody between election night and the audit, the audit is corrupted.
And these things are not, everything you've just described to me seems to be almost the least you can do and extremely easy to do, relatively speaking.
Relative to everything we've gone through with the machines, I would say it's easy, yes. There are different methods for hand counting. The manual audits are sort of, if we're going to go with risk limiting, I have nothing against risk limiting audits, but I do have a problem with pretending that they're going to, with the type of equipment we get, that will give a corrupted paper trail that will then result in a corrupted risk limiting audit. That's my problem with the risk limiting audit. Not all of them, by the way. The guy who invented risk limiting audits, Philip Stark at UC Berkeley, he's a professor.
Mm-hmm.
He gets it. He gets that the ballots need to be hand marked. At least if I may speak for Philip Stark. I don't mean to, I'm not quoting him on that.
No,
but,
I mean, again.
He appears to get it. There are some people who get it.
Unfortunately,
they're not the organizations who put out the public statements. They're the individuals.
Right. And I think that the education I just got, the schooling I just got, hopefully will share this knowledge with my listener. My parents, share with everybody who is listening. I really do think it's important.
Mr. and Mrs. Powell, how are you?
Yeah, no, they listen every week. So, at least I can count. I got two locked up. Once again, I want to thank you, Jennifer Cohn. Jennifer Cohn, again, attorney and election integrity advocate, extraordinaire. I want to thank you for being part of Powell to the People and making my fans, my listeners, a little bit wiser today than they have been, and we have at least 2 years, and so now from here on out, as I keep retweeting your stuff, I'll be making sure to make my own statements about hand marked ballots and putting that out there and making sure that, as you said, we reach that tipping point of information,
right,
where people kind of know and
right.
It becomes
it's
something.
Two hashtags, not one. It's not just paper ballots. It's hashtag hand marked, hashtag paper ballots.
All right. On it. Thank you, Jennifer.
All right, thank you so much for having me on.
No problem. This is what we call an extra. We're talking to Jennifer Cohn, election integrity advocate, and she just got some dope that I just heard. I hung the phone up and I said, you know what? Let's call her back and let's get her take on this last thing. So go, Jennifer. Tell me about Pennsylvania.
So something that one of my followers called to my attention recently is this sort of disturbing circumstances and sort of statistical oddness in Luzerne County, Pennsylvania, involving the 2016 election. And so this is what I've learned, and it has to do with Luzerne County primarily. This is something I'm just keeping an eye on, but it's very interesting. So President Obama won Luzerne County twice, but it's that particular county surged in the other direction for Trump, and he won it by 20 points. This is a quote from an article I have. Building up such a margin in this one county that it was 60% of his victory margin for the state of Pennsylvania.
Okay.
So that's Luzerne County. There was an article recently saying that the election official in Luzerne County was one of the people who sat on that ESNS election board, private advisory board that I told you about.
Yep.
And so there's Marissa Crispell, and I had posted about that, and the Pennsylvania, I guess one of my followers tagged the Pennsylvania Auditor General, who is already auditing the Pennsylvania election equipment. So she tagged him on my thread, and he is apparently going to, well, I hope he has subpoena power, but he's apparently going to ask her about this ESNS being the voting machine vendor advisory board that she sat on. And she was on the board. She proceeded then to recommend the purchase of electronic poll books from ESNS without disclosing to the other people who were making, the people who made the decision on her recommendation that she had sat on this ESNS advisory board and traveled to these ESNS conferences at ESNS's expense. So there's that. So that's Luzerne County. Then on top of it, there's a Luzerne County businessman named Johnny Yennison who was mentioned in the Democrats, did a Russia report. I guess it was the House Democrats, their Russia report. They mentioned him. And it appears that he's the one. Do you remember that prayer breakfast between with Russians and the NRA?
Yes.
And yeah, Alexander Torshin
right.
was there. So apparently he
in fact, the spy is in the news today.
Martina, the alleged Russian spy,
right.
And Alexander Torshin. And it seems Johnny Yennison is a Luzerne County businessman, and he apparently put Torshin and Butina in touch with members of the Trump campaign, according to the Democrats' Russia report. And then on top of it, also in Luzerne County, there's another businessman. I have his name down as Bolus, B-O-L-U-S. So he organized a rally called Miners for Trump, but is it turned out the whole Miners for Trump was started by Russian bots, and it's mentioned in one of their indictments. So it was actually a Russian-started thing, and when Bolus was asked how he came to how the rally came to be, even though he was either marching in it or he was in charge of it. I think he was in charge of it. He was holding the banner anyway. He said he didn't know.
Okay.
So there's all these things sort of happening in Luzerne County. And
well, it's funny because, I just looked up Luzerne County, and I've been to Luzerne County. Not that it matters that I've been to Luzerne County, but it's northeast Pennsylvania. And the reason why I think that's important is that's Joe Biden country. So
exactly.
So to say that,
it's
heavily
Democratic county.
Right,
heavily,
right.
Heavily. So here's the quote from, it says, Bob Bolus attends a Trump rally in March on Courthouse Square in Scranton. He hosted a Miners for Trump rally, but does not remember how it came about. Well, it came about because of Russian bots. And then you have another Luzerne businessman, Yennison, who's in touch with, Alexander Torshin, Russian senator. And he was in touch with Butina, the alleged Russian spy. And so there seems to be something unfolding, and I'd recommend that people follow the Auditor General in Pennsylvania, his Twitter account. I'm very interested to see where his investigation goes.
Well, I would love it if you posted on your Twitter account. Again,
I'll put
give
it on
give,
mine. His give, name give, is give, Eugene DePasquale. But I'll post it on mine. I'll have the thread at the top of my...
And one more time for the listener, how can they find you?
I am at Jenny Cohn 1, JennyCohn1. I also have a Medium account under Jennifer Cohn.
Okay. Well, again, Jennifer, thank you not only telling us about how bad these election our election infrastructure is, but giving us some spy talk, because I think that it's we talk about it. And I said as I introduced this this podcast, I said there are canaries in our coal mine, canaries in our Democratic
there you
coal
go.
Mine.
Wow, perfect circle.
And here we are back to the coal
back
country
coal
of northeastern Pennsylvania. It just all comes full circle. Thank you again for being a part of Power to the People. And we'll have you back because, this is not going away. And I think it's a problem that needs to be illuminated as much as we can. Thanks again, Jennifer.
Thank you.
You got it. And once again, I want to thank you for listening to Power to the People. Don't forget to subscribe to Power to the People, the OG Podcast Network, iTunes, Stitcher. We're even on iHeartRadio. You can find me at Comic Tony Powell on Twitter. Or you can follow our Twitter page for Powell to the People, Powell to the Peeps. That's P-O-L, I don't know my own name. That's P-O-W-E-L-L, the number two, the letters D-A, P-E-E-P-S, Powell to the People on Twitter. And you can follow us on Facebook at Powell to the People on Facebook. Thanks again, guys. Thanks for listening. Thanks for subscribing. Thanks for paying attention to us. See you next week.